In the years between 1941 and 1950, Ray Bradbury had done most of his writing in garages. Initially, he began writing inside the house, but was soon driven out and into the garages of at least two homes by his loving children who constantly wanted to play with him. And when he did relocate to the garage, his daughters would still come around the rear window to sing or just tap on the window pane. It was an impossible choice for Ray Bradbury, who had to choose between playing with his girls and endanger the family income, or finish what he was working on and push his daughters aside. Well, naturally, he chose playtime with his girls, but this made it obvious that he needed to find an office if they hoped to keep the house. The only problem was that the family could not afford it. When he finally found the place, the perfect place actually, it was the typing room in the basement of the library at the University of California. It's in the 1940s, there were rows and rows of old Remington and Underwood typewriters for the public to rent at a dime for half an hour. You'd thrust your dime into the machine and the clock would begin ticking, and you would try to get as much typing done in the following 30 minutes. It made the term, time is money, live up to a literal meaning. Now, this ticking clock appeared to pay off as Bradbury would have 25,000 words 9 days later and the first draft of what would become his best-selling novel. Welcome to House of Words, a podcast about writers, the future, and fire. I am your host, Jason Nemoore Hardin. Join us as we delve into Ray Bradbury's fire-engulfed novel, Fahrenheit 451. Stay drunk on writing so reality cannot destroy you. For writing allows just the proper recipes of truth, life, reality, as you are able to eat, drink, and digest without hyperventilating and flopping like a dead fish in your bed. I have learned on my journeys that if I let a day go by without writing, I grow uneasy. 2 days and I am in tremor. 3 and I suspect lunacy. 4 and I might as well be a hog suffering the flux in a wallow. An hour's writing is tonic. I'm on my feet, running in circles, and yelling for a clean pair of spats. End quote. Born on August 22, 1920, in Waukegan, Illinois, as Ray Douglas Bradbury to a Swedish immigrant mother and an English father. Literature would be present from early on in his life as he grew up on a steady diet of traditional ghost stories from the likes of Charles Dickens, H.P. Lovecraft, and Edgar Allan Poe, authors he would soon try imitating in his own stories. Now, he would later state that this imitating act went perhaps too far and that he wasn't able to find his own literary voice during this time. One can argue, however, that the fact that he wrote at least 1,000 words a day, every day, from the age of 12 on, whether trying to mimic someone else's writing or not, was far from a wasted endeavor as it provided him with precious practice. After years of writing, polishing his style, and finding his own voice, the first major highlight of many would occur when he was 22 years old writing the short story, The Lake. The story had been 10 years in the making, and after sweating for 2 hours on a porch under a scorching sun with a typewriter and a sudden fit of inspiration, he realized that he had written a truly good story. It was not a traditional ghost story at all, which was what he had focused much on in the past, but a story about love, time, remembrance, and drowning. He sent it off to his pulp agent, who liked it but told him that it could be a hard sell since it didn't fit into what horror and pulp magazines were normally looking for. Now, against the odds, however, the magazine Weird Tales decided to publish it, even though it didn't fit with their magazine. They paid him $20 for the story. It was published in May 1944 and would be far from the last time his writing, even when it veered outside the parameters, and perhaps particularly when it did, would make an impact. As with most great stories, Fahrenheit 451 was also an amalgamation of stories and experiences gathered up through time. When Ray was 9, he learned of the fires that had left the Alexandria Library in ancient Egypt in ashes. His own love affair with literature had begun with regular visits to the old Carnegie Athenaeum in Waukegan. But the fact that the books in Alexandria, which had been referred to as the gathering of the greatest stories of all time, had gone up in flames, shook him to the core. Now flash forward to 1934. Ray is 13 and living in Los Angeles. He is obsessed with movies and makes sure to catch at least a dozen of them on a weekly basis. Although he loves movies, he is repeatedly shocked by the sights that are shown before each motion picture feature. In grainy black and white images, teenage Bradbury witnessed Nazi soldiers throwing stacks of books into fires made of already burning literature. Reminiscent of the images he created in his mind of the Alexandria Library, but all the more real and close to reality, it was an inferno that brought tears to his eyes. In the introduction to a 1966 edition of Fahrenheit 451, he wrote, "When Hitler burned a book, I felt it as keenly, please forgive me, as his killing a human, for in the long sum of history, they are one and the same flesh." Though he wrote many short stories that would later influence the Fahrenheit 451 stories, such as The Reincarnate, Pillar of Fire, The Garbage Collector, and Sometime Before Dawn, among others, it was during a period in the late 1940s that he wrote what he would later call Five Ladyfinger Firecrackers, which would directly lead to the creation of Fahrenheit 451. Now, these five stories were The Bonfire, Bright Phoenix, The Exiles, Usher 2, and The Pedestrian, which all dealt with themes of censorship, banned books, and book burning, as well as the power of the individual. Each story was a social satire which addressed issues important to the author, none less than the final story he wrote in the build-up to the novel, The Pedestrian. It stemmed from a personal and quite bizarre experience. As Bradbury would tell it, the story took place on a late windy autumn night in Los Angeles when he and a friend, which he chose to keep anonymous, had been out for dinner in the Mid-Wilshire district. He and his friend were in deep conversation as they made their way towards a bus stop, as neither of them drove, which has a relevance as the story rolls on. As they walked, Ray ate some soda crackers, which, living up to his typically eccentric self, he had brought with him to and from the restaurant. And when a police car drove up beside them, it was obvious that the officer had stopped for them, and so they followed suit, curious what it could be about. The officer stepped out of the vehicle and approached them and asked what they were doing.
"Putting one foot in front of the other," Ray said, his mouth full of crackers.
Now, displeased, the officer repeated his question.
"Breathing the air," Ray replied. "Talking, conversing, walking."
And when he spoke, bits of cracker flew from his mouth, dusting the police officer's uniform and not making a very good impression. The officer then flicked the crumbs from his chest and shoulders. Now, Ray soon noticed the vibe the officer was expelling and said,
"It's illogical. You're stopping us. If we wanted to burgle a joint or rob a shop, we would have driven up in a car, burgled or robbed, and driven away. As you see, we have no car, only our feet."
Now, even in those days, Los Angeles was not known for foot traffic, and as he remembered it, the police officer appeared to be dumbfounded by the presence of two pedestrians walking about in the night. Now, the cop took Ray to be a smartass. However, the reality was that Ray was just being Ray. Innocently impudent, a little naive, and eccentric, as always.
"Walking, eh?" the officer asked, not buying their claim of innocence. "Just walking?"
Ray and his friend nodded, wondering if they were the victims of some strange joke.
"Well, don't do it again,"
the officer exclaimed, then returned to his patrol car and drove off into the night. Incensed by the experience, Ray, upon arriving home, wrote The Pedestrian,
a story about a future society in which walking is forbidden and all pedestrians are treated as criminals. Now, the tale follows one man, a writer in the year 2053, who still enjoys the lost pastime of late-night walks, while others sit inside their little homes watching television. Now, his agent sent the story to countless magazines, from the top slicks to the science fiction pulp magazines, but it did not sell. Probably because it was too political, Ray surmised. Inspired to expand on the concepts of his short stories and after realizing that the library would have to be his office for the time being, he would wake up at 7 in the morning, take the bus to the library, and remain there, writing until dusk. When the 1993 introduction to the 40th anniversary edition of Fahrenheit 451, he recalled, "I cannot possibly tell you what an exciting adventure it was." Day after day, he would attack rentable typing machines, shoving dimes into them and pounding away like a madman, then rushing upstairs to fetch more dimes, running in and out of rooms, pulling out books, scanning pages, reading between writing sessions, breathing in book dust with gusto and allowing himself to be fully engulfed by the flames of literature. There simply could not be a more suitable place to write a novel about burning books in the future than where he found himself. Well, 9 days after he'd begun, at a total cost of $9.80, which amounted to 49 hours of typewriter time, Ray Bradbury had written a 25,000-word novella, which at the time was titled Long After Midnight. It was the story of a fireman named Montag who in a distant future would, instead of putting out fires, start them by burning the most dangerous of all inspirational artifacts, books. But just like it had happened with the pedestrian, publishers found it too political and rejected the story. In the early 1950s, Ray Bradbury was not yet a household name, but he was, however, one of the top players in the science fiction, horror, and fantasy arena. In that circle, he was nothing short of a celebrity. By this time, Long After Midnight had been changed to The Fireman, and Bradbury was eager to get it out to the world. So his editors shopped The Fireman to magazines such as Harper's and Esquire, but none of the major literary publications were interested. Finally, the novella sold for $300 to Horace Gold, the editor of Galaxy Magazine, a science fiction pulp publication, and was published in February 1951. Then came 2 years when other stories, other books, and radio projects would take hold of his attention, leaving The Fireman to be forgotten. Initially, he had hoped to include The Fireman in The Illustrated Man and then The Golden Apples of the Sun, but decided to cut the lengthy short story from both books when his editor felt it was unfit for either collection. Enter Ian Ballantyne of Ballantyne Publishing. Ian had read Ray's work and saw great potential in him, potential he was sure expanded beyond the realm of short story collections. Well, wanting to expand his publishing company, he reached out to him. Ian told Ray that he wanted him to write for Ballantyne, a company that would break new ground in publishing by offering, simultaneously, both paperback and hardcover books in a time when no other publishers did this. Well, after discussions in late 1952, Ray signed with Ballantyne to write a collection that would include the novella, The Fireman. However, all parties involved agreed that the story could be elaborated on and agreed that the novella would be written with an additional 25,000 words. The advance for this new book was $5,000. And though his stature as an American writer had grown dramatically, he was still financially strapped, which made this advance from Ballantyne a very welcomed one. Ray had finally made his garage into an office. Nevertheless, he would soon find himself returning to the library at UCLA to find the peace and quiet he needed in order to work. And though he had the advance from Ballantyne, money was still scarce and he knew that he needed to finish that novel. Making matters worse, the Bradburys had recently bought a dishwasher and a dining room that would be paid for in monthly installments. These installments naturally came with interest, and when he opened the first bill and saw the interest rate, he was alarmed and became ever more determined to finish those payments, and quickly. So with that, he returned to the early bus drives and the long hours at the library. In rewriting the story, he felt pressured to consult his original story. However, he worried that would have the opposite effect on his writing. Of this, he said, "I feared for refiring the book and rebaking the characters. I'm a passionate, not intellectual writer, which means my characters must plunge ahead of me to live the story. If my intellect caught up with them too swiftly, the whole adventure might mire down in self-doubt and endless mind play." Additionally, there was also the problem of his other publisher, Doubleday. Now, at the time, he was somewhat frustrated with Doubleday, since they insisted on marketing him as a purely science fiction writer to a purely science fiction audience. He felt limited. On the other hand, Ian Ballantyne recognized not only the growing popularity of science fiction, but also its literary potential, which Bradbury took as a fresh breath of air. So the choice was easy for Ray, but Doubleday didn't want their prime science fiction writer to release a novel with someone else. In the end, Doubleday passed on the fireman and allowed him to find publishing elsewhere as long as it was not published as a novel but as a story within a collection. Wanting to throw a new spin on the story and make it feel free and inspired, instead of referring to the source material, Bradbury let the characters speak to him like they had the first time around. The passing of time helped, thus he now felt he could write the story with both a familiarity and the new breath of fresh air it needed. Now, the first hours of writing flew by with ease, basically spilling out of him. The plot line was still the same, the characters were still in place, Fireman Montague, his pill-popping wife, Mildred, and Clarice McClellan, who told Montague about the power of the books that he burned each night. However, there were some changes, even if they were minor. Fire Chief Leahy became Fire Chief Betty, certain scenes were tossed out, others were fleshed out, the language evolved to become more poetic, and the story expanded as it was being written once again. Additionally, he hyped up the fire and sun symbolism. Once again, in just 9 days, he finished, this time producing the first draft of the novel. Then, in January 1953, Ray returned to his garage office to revise the draft. He was still without a title for the book as he struggled to find a particularly powerful and symbolic one, one that suited the novel. Then, on the afternoon of January 22nd, as sunlight streamed in through the garage windows, he had a revelation. He decided that he might as well use the temperature at which book paper catches on fire as the title of the book. So he called around to several chemistry departments at various universities, but was disappointed when none of them could provide him with an exact temperature. He then made inquiries to several physics professors, also with no luck. Finally, it came to him, why not call the professionals when it came to fires? The fire department. After a quick phone call to the downtown Los Angeles firehouse, Ray Bradbury had his answer. The temperature at which books burn was and is 451 degrees Fahrenheit. The fireman had told him that book paper ignites at 451 degrees Fahrenheit. He simply reversed it to Fahrenheit 451, and that was it. He had his title. He never bothered to double-check if it was indeed correct, because he liked the ring of the numbers. The book was set for publication in October 1953, so he got to work. By mid-June, he sent the first half of the unfinished manuscript to Ballantyne's editor-in-chief, Stanley Kaufman, who was Ray's editor on the novel. Kaufman recalled making some structural changes and suggested shifting some scenes. Bradbury agreed. The pair also agreed that Kaufman would travel to Los Angeles in August to review the proofs with him. According to Kaufman, They did so Ray would have a final deadline and not continue on polishing the piece forever. Kaufman stayed in a hotel on Wilshire Boulevard about a mile from the Bradbury home, and he and Ray spent long days in the hotel room editing the proofs of Fahrenheit 451. There, Ray would pace back and forth anxiously, trying to keep himself motivated and focused despite the fatigue. According to his wife, Mary, his attention span had always been rather short, so when it came time to edit proofs, it drove him crazy. Even though he wanted to move on to the next project, the next story, he had no choice if he wanted the book to get published. Kaufman remembered one more important detail, that Ray was constantly asking him to go out for ice cream, his one lifelong vice. His wife would say that just like some people are addicted to drugs, Ray's drug of choice was ice cream. I'm right there with you, Ray. So Kaufman and Ray would walk to a nearby soda fountain at least once a day and often several times a day. Later, Kaufman would exclaim how he'd never eaten more ice cream in his entire life than he did during that period. Nevertheless, by the end of the week, after strenuous work and numerous pints of ice cream, the editing process was complete and Fahrenheit 451 was done. Both Bradbury and Kaufman knew it was brilliant, though neither man had any way of knowing what kind of impact it would go on to make. Despite the anti-McCarthy sentiment of the book, Kaufman claimed he was unaware of what he had on his hands and that none at Ballantyne had any idea how political the book was. To put it more into context, World War II was still in fresh memory at the time, and the Ballantyne editors assumed it was a response to Hitler, which, in a way, based on newsreel Bradbury had been horrified and inspired by in his teenage years as a cinema buff, was not incorrect. After nearly 50 years, Kaufman's memory of the editing process was a bit blurry. However, he was adamant about one thing. Every single word in Fahrenheit 451 was Ray Bradbury's. In mid-August 1953, Kaufman flew back to New York City with the final version of the book in his luggage. To fulfill his agreement with Doubleday that the book be a collection rather than a novel, the first edition of Fahrenheit 451 included two additional short stories. These were The Playground and The Rock Cried Out. The original plan was to include 8 stories in addition to Fahrenheit 451, but Ray didn't have time to revise all the tales, so they settled with 2. The Playground and The Rock Cried Out were removed in later printings, but Ray met his contractual obligation with the first edition. Fahrenheit 451 was indeed a short novel, but it was also a part of a collection. Upon its publication on October 19, 1953, Fahrenheit 451 earned high praise from critics across the nation. Though not immediately ascending Bradbury to stardom, Fahrenheit 451 went on to become his best-selling book as time went on. The first hardcover printing was 4,250 copies, while 250,000 paperback copies were simultaneously released. Sales were steady over the decades, gradually building as the book gained cultural relevance. By the end of the 1980s, the novel was in its 79th printing, with 4.5 million copies in circulation. In a 2002 interview, Bradbury revealed that he could retire on the royalties of that one book alone, if he so wanted. Fahrenheit 451 now sits comfortably next to other dystopian masterworks such as Orwell's 1984 and Huxley's Brave New World, and its author, Ray Bradbury, is no longer just a science fiction writer, but a respected author who fits right alongside other greats such as Hemingway, Faulkner, Fitzgerald, and numerous others. As usual, let's wrap this episode up with a quote. This one from the pedestrian himself. If you're writing without zest, without gusto, without love, without fun, you're only half a writer.
It means you are so busy keeping one eye on the commercial market or one ear peeled for the avant-garde coterie that you are not being yourself. You don't even know yourself. For the first thing a writer should be is excited. He should be a thing of fevers and enthusiasms. Without such vigor, he might as well be out picking peaches or digging ditches. God knows it'd be better for his health. End quote. Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this episode and will spread the word about the podcast. Once again, I have been your host, Jason Nemore Hardin. We here at House of Words ask that you please consider helping to make this show easier to produce and more frequent by contributing on our Patreon page at patreon.com/houseofwords or paypal.me/houseofwordspodcast. Alternatively, you can subscribe and encourage others to subscribe to our YouTube page at House of Words Podcast. Every little bit helps, more than you might think. Until next time, keep turning those pages. House of Words is written and produced by Christo M. Sanchez. Narrated and written by me, Jason Nemore Hardin. And music by Creature 9 and Wood. All rights and ownership belong to Christo M. Sanchez and Jason Nemore Hardin.